It's 8 a.m. Eastern Wartime. WEAF, New York. Ladies and gentlemen, from the newsroom in New York, here are reports on late developments at home and overseas by staff reporters in Europe, the Far East, and in our own capital. Now for news from Great Britain, we take you first to London.
This is John McVane in London. Authoritative quarters in London have no fresh information on the situation in Singapore today. The last official news from the island arrived here early this morning. At that time, fighting was continuing in the western and northern sectors, and the Japanese had intensified their activity in the northern area. Early this morning, the Japanese supported their attack with dive bombing and machine gunning from the air. It stated that they are using medium tanks. British counterattacks on the Japanese left flank are said to be successful. When the statement was made, the British line extended from the naval base in the north through the center of the island to Tanglin in the south, and from Sungai Sunya, the line ran north. There doesn't appear to be any change in Burma, and the enemy is still believed to be holding Martaban. Since we haven't had any news of them so far today, it's presumed that the German warships, Scharnhorst, Gneisenau, and Prince Eugen, have probably reached their home port in Heligoland Bight. The warships, accompanied by torpedo boats, E-boats, destroyers, and minesweepers, crept out of the bomb-battered port of Brest on the French coast sometime during Wednesday night. The weather was misty enough yesterday so that visibility on the surface of the sea was only about 3 miles. Heavy cloud layers hanging at about 1,500 feet gave them some protection from air observation. But about 2.5 hours after dawn, they were spotted just as they were about to enter the channel. German fighters based on the French coast gave them strong protection as British planes and destroyers came for the attack. People on the Dover coast couldn't see the vessels they knew were somewhere out in the mist, but the big guns on the English Channel coast started lobbing shells at the unseen targets. Swordfish torpedo bombers of the Fleet Air Arm, escorted by RAF fighters, swooped in low against heavy fire from the German warships and the German fighter planes. One torpedo is reported to have hit one of the heavy ships, and a British motor torpedo boat also claimed a torpedo hit. But the damage couldn't be seen through the heavy smoke screen that German flotilla put up. RAF bombers attacked time and again, but the low cloud bank made verification of the bomb hits uncertain. Bomber crews said they were confident that bombs had struck each of the two Fokker battleships and the cruiser. Coastal command planes said they scored 3 hits with torpedoes. British destroyers first sighted the enemy about 3:45 yesterday afternoon, nearly 5 hours after the German warships were first reported out of Brest. The destroyers tackled a heavy German craft in a rain squall. They had to face terrific fire from the warships and bombing from German planes. The destroyers are thought to have obtained at least 1 torpedo hit. The Admiralty communique issued early this morning said that when last sighted, the enemy had become separated and were making for their ports in Heligoland Bight. Ordinarily, the German warships would have reached their home ports 3 or 4 hours ago. But if they've been hit by at least 6 torpedoes and a number of bombs, their speed may have been slowed down. The British lost 20 bombers, 16 fighters, and 6 swordfish in the continuous attacks. 18 German fighters were shot down. The British had been expecting for some time that the German warships would move out of Brest. When the ships came out of dry dock, the British pressed home bombing attacks night after night. In all, the RAF made 109 attacks in the port. Authoritative British quarters aren't alarmed by the German move. If the warships had been in any condition to start Atlantic commerce raiding, they'd probably have headed straight out to sea rather than risk the passage through the channel. I was talking with a British naval officer the other day about the condition of the Fokker battleships. He said the morale of the German crews penned up in Brest for 10.5 months must be very bad. He said that in all probability they'd need several weeks of training in quiet waters before they'd be fit to man the ships in a campaign of raiding in the Atlantic. The fact the vessels did head for home is taken here as evidence that for the moment they've given up the idea of taking part in the Battle of the Atlantic. Probably the German naval command decided that the vessels could never be properly refitted in Brest, and so ordered them home for a complete overhaul. Since we have no exact information on how badly they are damaged, it's impossible to say how long this overhaul will take. The British are pretty sore at the fact that the Germans were able to slip through the channel. One RAF man said today, "Naturally, you're angry when your enemy walks into your front garden and you can't shoot him. But generally speaking, the British say the German warships are no better off in Heligoland than in Brest." They point out that if the vessels had headed from Brest into the Atlantic to raid Comus, the job of tracking them down might have been extremely difficult. But the British keep a day and night watch over the North Sea and the Norwegian coast, and they have a feeling that it's just as well to have all the German fleet concentrated in one spot. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
And here's news from Moscow to the effect that that great Russian winter offensive has driven into White Russia. Ski soldiers carried the fighting into the westernmost Soviet republic. Battle zone dispatchers say they were aided by guerrillas, and it's indicated that parachutists also may have helped in this deepest thrust yet by the Red Army. The dispatches reading Moscow indicate the object of the thrust through German lines is to cut Nazi communications. We take you now to the newsroom in San Francisco.
Stationed in the capital city of the Dutch East Indies is Sidney Albright, who is ready now to report the news from the Far East. Go ahead, Batavia.
This is Sidney Albright speaking in Batavia. The time is 7:36 on Friday evening. In the latest Netherlands Indies communique, very little enemy action is reported. Last night, the harbor district of Makassar was still in flames as a result of the extensive destruction which has been carried out by the Dutch forces. Apparently, this work has also been completed in the other parts of the southwest Soleti. Those received from MacArthur indicate that the original announcement of an enemy landing at Salim Ipa has since proved to be incorrect. There are no reports from the other theaters of war in the Indies Archipelago, except for enemy air reconnaissance conducted mainly over the outer provinces. After the first real Japanese aerial onslaught, action over the island of Java has been negligible. The reason for this lull is undoubtedly because of the strengthening of Dutch as well as Allied opposition. There has been repeated attempts to reach both the Batavia and the Surabaya Harriers, but the fast planes have succeeded in driving off the invaders before any damage was done. Shortly before the attack on Pontianak in Borneo, writes one of the local dailies, the postmaster collected all the money in the building. He expected the enemy at any moment and wanted to make sure the funds in his care were not destroyed. He collected a total of about $350,000, which he handed to a fisherman who was standing on the pier just before putting out to sea. The postmaster, when giving the money to the fisherman, instructed him to take it to Java. In a small city on the Java seacoast, a civil servant is still trying to recover from the shock of having an unknown man hand him this large sum of money without any explanation. The thoroughness with which the Japanese planned their invasion of Java is becoming more and more evident every day. Surabaya was their most important espionage center, but the work was conducted in every corner of the Indies, and the consulate general at Batavia, with its secret code and radio room, was the clearinghouse. Consular couriers were their special privileges, carried the documents back to Tokyo. Before the war started, there were 500 Japanese fishing boats operating in the Indies waters and manned by 4,000 alleged fishermen, whose cast was so small from a commercial standpoint that there was no doubt as to their undercover activities. Since the invasion was launched, their thoroughness has paid big dividends. When Tarakan was occupied, a large number of Japanese civilians accompanying the enemy landing forces were recognized as former Kuli employees of the Tarakan Oil Company. A Japanese officer in the Balik Pipeline operation was identified as an ice merchant who had lived in the city for 5 years. A former consular clerk was recently arrested on the island of Philippon, dressed in native clothes, with 50,000 guilders in his pocket. Another case was uncovered a few days ago when an enemy bomber was shot down near Surabaya. On examining one of the occupants, it was found that his clothes bore the mark of a Java clothing. Incidentally, another occupant of the bomber, who was trying to pass himself off as a Japanese, had been killed. He was later identified as a German. Although the Japanese nation devoted most of their time to stirring up the native population, there have been no indications so far of any real success in this regard.
That was Sidney Albright in Batavia. We now hear from Earl Godwin speaking from the newsroom in Washington.
And good morning, folks. This may be an unlucky day, Friday the 13th, to some folks, but it's really a day to run up the flag in our own hearts, because this is the day on which the Stars and Stripes were accorded the first salute in a foreign port in 1778. That was John Paul Jones sailing into a French harbor with the new flag of the new republic, and the governor of the port, whose name was Admiral Piquet, ordered a salute. I have a communication here from Santa Claus. In the guise of a letter from the Association of Sugar Producers of Puerto Rico, they have offered to give the government 300,000 tons of sugar, the American people, that is, 300,000 tons of sugar a year to add to the supply. They are working on a sugar quota, handcuffed as the amount they can send us. They could give us 1,500,000 tons if the handcuffs were off. They're allowed to give us only 960,000 tons. They have an anticipated harvest of 1,200,000 tons. And as I say, they're allowed to give us only a fraction of that. The offer has gone officially to Donald Nelson, the head man in production here. It would mean, says the association, 6 extra spoonsful of sugar a week. The association also points out that growers in Florida and Louisiana could increase their sugar output if the government here would take off the quota handcuffs. To most people, it certainly seems odd to have a tough sugar ration, so tough that we're threatened with worse than Volstead law penalties, and at the same time not permitted to grow enough sugar to alleviate the shortage. It's something we don't know about, and I'm going to try to find out about it today. This army needs fighting planes and ships now. William Batt certainly spoke a burning truth the other day when he said that the planes we build next year cannot hold our tottering outposts now. We also need fighting men. There are over 65,000 applications for various specialty jobs, lawyers, scientists, and whatnot in the Army, but what they need right now is truck drivers, tank mechanics, and 1 million or 2 million hard-fisted athletic young men to handle the guns. And along that line, I have a letter today from a sergeant in the 2nd Armored Division at Fort Benning, Georgia, and it is a joy to read part of it to you. He says, I'm a motor sergeant responsible for all the vehicles in the battery. They're all combat vehicles except a few harder to maintain than civilian cars because these vehicles have to be perfect at all times. No excuse is accepted if a vehicle won't start if it falls out on the road. There's much about them I can't tell, but they're the best I've ever seen. They have lead bronze bearings, oil cool units, hydraulic valve lifters, sodium-cooled valves, and so many other features which are found only on the standard high-priced cars. Some of these things are so far advanced they've never been on any car. As near as I can interpret the mood of the men here, a realization that all this war was forced on us, a complete confidence in the government and the commanders, knowledge that we're getting the best that industry and the public can give, a feeling that the people back home are depending on us, knowledge that the enemy is tough, but that we're tougher, and a determination to win with no doubt in anybody's mind about it. You know, that is a great joy to read here from Washington, because there are mountains and mountains and mountains of dope handed out every day in the line of blue critical stuff. Just a moment to tell you that increased prices on canned goods are not justified by the government restrictions on the use of tin cans, and that comes directly from Price Administrator Leon Henderson himself, and that's all from Washington at this time.
And that's the news up to this moment. These have been reports by John McVain in London, Sidney Albright in Batavia, and Earl Godwin in Washington. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.